and welcome to Opus on Siouxland Public Media. I'm your host, Gretchen Gondek. I first noticed Ioana Galou on the stage of the Orpheum Theater in the violin section of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. Ioana is a striking young woman with raven locks. She's tall and athletic. As I interviewed her for this series, I learned she is a native of Romania and is an accomplished musician nationally and internationally. She attended a prestigious music academy in her native country, served on the faculty at Heidelberg University, Bowling Green State University, and the College of Worcester. In 2016, Galou became assistant professor of violin and a member of the Rollins Piano Trio at the University of South Dakota. She has been on the faculty of the Eastern Music Festival in Greensboro, North Carolina, since 2004. Galou grew up under communist rule during some of the darkest days of the Ceausescu regime. Despite the challenges and difficulties of her life, Galou was raised by loving parents in a happy home. Here is her story.
Very young kids, we didn't know better. We didn't know anything else. And it's funny to look back, and we were thinking all that was normal. Long lines of people waiting in front of stores to buy the basics, milk, bread, eggs, you name it. And so many jokes about you saw a line, you just stood there because for sure they would have something that you would want to buy. Ceausescu had this whole blown up megalomania and this whole facade and big demonstration of support for him and military display, and how the whole country was so happy to live in the golden epoch. That's how it was called, golden epoch. Never mind that the electricity was cut several times a day. It would just, boom, it would go off. Because Ceausescu tried to pay the external debt that Romania had. So he starved the population in the process. So there was no freedom of speech. You could not say to anyone, you know, this is very hard, I've had it, or I'm going to leave the country. You couldn't leave the country. You couldn't say anything about the regime. You would just be, not you if you're a kid, but the parents could go to jail because there were informants, unfortunately, everywhere that worked undercover. And right after the king, I have to go back a little bit, we had a constitutional monarchy before the communists came. And yes, I am a royalist at heart. The Hohenzollern family, King Mihai, and the whole royal family have done tremendous job in leading Romania. And it was a constitutional monarchy. There was a government, there was a parliament, there was like everything in place. The communists started to gain traction in Russia during the 1918 revolution, and then slowly they infiltrated in Romania. They formed the first communist party in, I think, 1921, if I remember correctly, while we had the king and the royal family. And they got to the power right after the war, because, you know, Russia and the United States basically saved the day after the during the Second World War, because there was no other way out. And you know, many people in Eastern Europe learned much later how many people the U.S. lost. Unbelievable amounts. All we heard was what Russia lost and how much they did for us, and I don't contest that. But we were under the zone that was liberated by the Russia, by the Russian people. So we became communist. Everybody became communist that were liberated by the Russians. And Western Europe and the other side were liberated, freed by the United States. So they weren't communists. There is, you know, that's what happened. So immediately the communists organized this makeshift vote. And we voted, quotation marks, voted to have the king out of the country. That was horrible. So the royal family was kicked out of our own country. And I heard so many stories from my parents and from people that lived those days. It was like funeral when the royal train with the royal guard was leaving. There were like bazillion people crying and waving and honoring them. So it was a stolen vote. Complete fake. So we lost the king, royal family. The royal guard went with him. I heard from people that lived that the families of the royal guards were decimated after that by the communists. So that's when it started in 1945. Horrible. Anybody that tried to say anything to the jail, communist jails. And the political jails were horrible. We never knew about them, but I'll get to them, to that, until after the revolution. They would take people they wanted. It came from Lenin. Lenin wanted that, and all the communist governments complied. Take out the leaders, take out the intellectuals, put them in jail. Have masses that would comply, and they will listen and they will follow. So they are online. I actually looked them up at some point to see what Lenin asked. Put them in buildings where they could hear each other, keep them in fear. Pick weak leaders. Put unqualified people in higher positions. There was a lot of people that joined the Communist Party. They were advanced. And what happened right after the Second World War, they took all the land from the peasants. They took it away. They called it the collectives, like Russia did. So they took it. And my grandfather was an agronomist, and he was very depressed because he had to measure the land and make, you know, say what was going on and who had what. And people didn't want to sign, so they were coerced to sign, and he knew, and it was horrible. So that was huge tragedy in the country. So fast forward, nothing changed until the 80s. When I was 70s, I was born in 74, nothing really changed. Ceausescu came in 65, and he tried to lessen things at the beginning, so the life got better, but not for long. So he tried to just pay the external debt, and no electricity, no food. Electricity would come back in the evening for some period of time, then would be taken away again. I was so used to that. I didn't even blink. I had a stand with two supports for candles. I practiced the candles light. We had oil lamps. I'm a doctor in how to use an oil lamp. I'm perfect. I know how to maintain it. Perfect. What saved us was taking it lightly. We tried to also have humor. Looking into this, it was a general tragedy, but you know, people loved, went to school, went to concerts, played music, read literature, watched some movies. We could watch a lot of movies that weren't contemporary from the Western Bloc. So I know a lot of the old-time movies from the US. That's interesting. Many times I would watch them, and I don't know, beautiful feelings. But we didn't see movies made in the 80s or no. So we didn't even know what was going on. You had to go, and every month you would get that much wheat flour, that much corn flour, that much sugar, that much oil. I think that was all that was rationed in my hometown. In my hometown, you could buy bread if you found it. In Cluj, no. It was on a, you had a punch card for bread, for example. You know, those things got old for us. We couldn't just wallow all the time. We worked, we had fun, we met with friends. I think the sense of community was immense. And people read a lot. To this day, my escape is reading a book when I'm drinking my coffee or tea in the morning. I read a lot. Everybody from my generation reads. I don't own a TV. I watch movies on my iPad if I'm so inclined. So it's interesting that in the greatest tragedy, there is so much light and so much spiritual awakening. We didn't take any person for granted. We knew that anybody could be taken away from us, that life could be taken away from us. And yet we worked. The revolution started December 1989. So there was this radio station in the United States, Europe Free, that broadcast for us. Of course, it was illegal to listen to it. The whole country was listening. How did we know? I remember many times at the time when the program was about to start, it was always in the evening, so everybody could be home from work and to listen. That meant if it was broadcast live at that moment and not recorded, it was very, like a big time difference. Like 7 hours between Romania and the United States. And anyway, the program started with Enescu's first Rhapsody, and it was blaring throughout the city. You could hear it, and then you heard the voice of the gentleman. This is Radio Free Europe, Europa Libera. We all listened. So we knew from them that the Berlin Wall collapsed in November. We knew. And we were really excited because what a shame to have that wall there. And terrible. How many people died trying to cross? A horrible, horrible idea. So we didn't know. I was in school. We were finishing school. First semester, it was winter, very cold. And all of a sudden, everybody was told, you have to go home. Would you just go home? Just get out of the city. You go home and free tickets, just go home. And we had no idea what was going on, but we knew something was up. But nobody told us anything. So December 21st, I'm at home with my family, Radio Europe Free. They interrupt the program and they said, you need to hear something. There is a revolution in Romania. This is what's happening. Timișoara is under attack and this is what's happening. And so it transpired that people in Timișoara, that is like really huge city, like at that time, for Romanian standards, for European standards, 800,000 people were at that time living in Timișoara, historical city built during the Romans. You know what I'm talking about. Beautiful. People apparently went out on the streets and revolted starting December 16th. And we didn't know anything, but something was up. And somebody, I think an American reporter, there were foreign individuals in Timișoara that quickly their governments tried to get them out of that hell. Some made it, some didn't. My knowledge is that all the U.S. citizens at that time in Timișoara made it. So one American young reporter in the middle of that whole hell with those tape recorders, you remember back in the day, like held it up and record it about a minute of that horrible happening. So that's what we heard. December 21, the tape. And I don't know if anybody that heard that tape at that time and was old enough to get it. And trust me, we were very old, 16 years old. We were old already. It was such a shock to hear that our own army was killing our own people. I was like, no way, no way. So I heard water cannons, I heard gunshots, and I heard people yelling, shame on you, we are Romanians like you, how dare you, and kids screaming. I was sobbing, I was in a shock. I don't think I even had words to talk for a few days. It was such a numbing moment. Well, the next morning, the whole country was on the streets. So that was a horrible to witness. And the army killed a lot of Romanians at that time. There was like a lot of blood, a lot of tragedy, and very many young people died. Just why, you know, so many. I think most of us took a long time to get over this and move on. Looking back, I think, seriously, I must have been depressed for at least 1 year or two after that. You do your work, you practice, and you go on, and yeah, we are free. But the desperation and the depression, there was blood on some walls in Cluj, where I went to school. They wasn't even washed for years. For us to remember flowers and pictures of the people that were killed right there. And just senseless killing. So something that was hard to recover from. Just why? And to know that you survived it and you move on and other people didn't. A lot of thoughts that you have. And I think I harbored a lot of anger until much later in life. And I had a recurring nightmare. And at the University of Cincinnati, a tremendous counselor, psychologist, actually, I went to talk about it. And she said that's very easy to stop the nightmare from recurring, on how to wake up when it happens. But you are dealing with such anger toward that happening. So she helped me deal with that much later on in life, much later than I should have. So now I have to say I'm at peace, and I understand that things happen, and compassion and love is the answer. I'm coming from a family of a long musical tradition, except for my parents. We are three sisters. They are both retired math and physics teachers. And they shared an immense love for music. They met as freshmen at the University of Cluj in Romania. And they have been inseparable since. The most beautiful love story. They have stayed strong for over 40 years. I adore them, tremendous role models. They went to opera, they went to philharmonic, so they knew, they had immense love for music. So the three sisters, you know, they took us to concerts. And this is a true funny story. One time I was about five, I think. I don't remember it very well, I remember enough. They took us to Don Pasquale. And for some reason, I felt compelled to conduct. So I stood on the chair and started to conduct. And they were petrified. They tried to make me silent and calm down. And they tried to actually make me sit again. Well, I ran away and I started conducting from another corner. So poor people, they asked for help from other friends to actually bring me back to the chair and not disturb. I don't think I was disturbing, I was conducting. Well, after that episode, they came home, they were, you know, everybody knew them in our city.
And they spoke to my grandmama and they said, you know, we may not take her to more concerts, not until she's more grown up. Grandmama said, you know what, let's take her to the music school and she's gonna shut up during the concerts if she learns an instrument and she's gonna appreciate it. So I was older, I was about 8 years old, which is late, it was late for Communist Romania. There was this afternoon music program. It was free if you got in. So you went to school and then in the afternoon you went back to the music school every day. Very serious, free training. It was sponsored by the state. But you had to get in. So big exam, entrance exam. And I got in. It's also a long, funny story how I got in because I forgot the song. I was very flustered and yet they thought I was worth it to get in. Even a little later than usual. And my grandmama assured them she will not make a career. We want her to appreciate the music and to just be, you know, responsible citizen, to listen to the concerts and just learn an instrument. So they admitted me, and it was a rocky start for me because I was also a professional runner. They had a very good running program in my home city, so I was training a lot. I was doing homework. I think I was very good in school, in academically speaking. So finally, about 2 years in the music program, I really got this incredible love for violin. It was a spring break when my teacher told my dad, you know, she's not improving enough. She's taking the place of someone who actually could do much more. And this is the stuff she needs to do during the spring break. And my dad, who reads musical notation very well, and he actually was singing in the one professional choir in our town. He was the only non-professional singer, and he made auditions, so he was in there, and he took violin lessons as a kid. So he worked with me 2 weeks. He took it very seriously. And I remember her telling me later, very close to my first violin teacher, she told me later, I gave him an impossible amount of material to cover with you just to prove that you are not cutting it. And sure enough, I came after 2 weeks, everything was done. And I remember her being completely shocked. But that was the turning point for me, that I said, I cannot live without the violin. I will not go on without the violin. So I started to improve very, very quickly because I was obviously behind, because I wasn't practicing enough. I kept running as well. So I started to win some regional, national competitions. And then by the age of 12, she said, you need to go to Cluj. That's the biggest city in Transylvania with the biggest musical tradition. She said, I think you need to go there now if you really are serious about music. So my parents were very stressed about musician life in communism because nobody could leave the country. And if you could not leave the country forever, or it was just very closed. And all you could do, to the best you could hope, would be to be a soloist within the country and maybe tour or be in the Philharmonic. Most of the people that actually made it into the conservatory, and I'm talking highest level conservatories you can imagine, but we were all confined. We could not leave the country. Lots of tragic stories of people that tried to leave, actually. And they would finish the conservatory and they would be sent to some villages to teach music in schools. It was very, very heartbreaking. And my parents debated. They said, well, you're winning mathematics competitions. You are doing well in school. Are you sure this is what you want? Because you can have a much better life if you go the science route. And I was so dead set, this is it. So at 13, after promising my parents that I will keep the highest academic standards, they put me on a boarding school in Cluj. I made the admission. It was a very, very hard admission with solfège, theory, dictation, violin playing. I got in. They accepted two people, myself and another girl that year. So seventh grade, I went to Cluj. It was so harsh because we were alone in a dorm that, to say it was substandard, it's an euphemism. There was no food. We had a cafeteria and people tried the best to feed us somehow. But I remember being cold and hungry a lot, that I remember. And we forged amazing friendships. The academic standards were through the roof high. The whole country learned from the same books. So very, very, very much. So we went to school from 8 to 2 o'clock and then applied lessons, practicing. I remember many times, like I knew you either practice or get out of this career. So I remember many times finishing the school at 2 o'clock and seeing most of my colleagues going home and take a nap or, you know, play outside. And I would just walk and go practice for hours and hours and hours. And many times I would just take breaks to do my homework. That was my break, my fun time. And then you would have a dinner at the cafeteria. I never liked that food. I remember not being able to eat it. Some people would say, yeah, you get hungry enough, you eat it. No, I didn't. I just, many times I just went hungry. I said, I can't eat this. And they tried so hard. I mean, people like everyone else, they tried to help us, but that's what there was. You couldn't go to the store and buy bread, for example. That was just not in Cluj. You had to show that you are from that city and you had an X number of breads you could buy. I couldn't. I was not from Cluj. So it was really, really an interesting time when we detached from a lot of material things. To this day, I can't care less about the material possessions because they could be taken away from you. Family members could be taken away from you or friends. I'm switching a little bit around. We were very focused. We have to practice. We didn't have very good instruments. If you could, you'd get a good violin, but not all of us could. I didn't have a good violin practically ever until I got under management. And it's amazing to remember that you couldn't buy strings. You couldn't find violin strings in Romania. Not Tomastic, not Dominant or whatever existed. You couldn't. They had some Romanian strings called Hora, bless their hearts, but you could not play on those. So we tried to ask friends from Western Europe to send them us some strings. And that was also a new set of problems because if you got correspondence from Western Europe, they started to fret that you are plotting something. And, you know, you'd get the envelope open and they were like, oh, just violin strings. But they were looking so much. So I remember I had one set of strings and you asked for the hardest steel strings to actually use forever. They don't even make those anymore. They were Tomastic black steel, complete steel, and they would keep for a while. And I don't think they sounded that great, but we learned to this day, I can play anything, no problem. And if a string would break, you'd make a knot to fix it, and then you played. It was really a hard time. So all we cared about to have strings on the violin. I remember before the revolution, right as I was starting high school in that summer, one of my friends left with her family. To this day, I can't believe they were allowed to visit somebody in the US, some blood relatives. And they visited and came back. So probably they showed enough that they could just go and visit and come back. And I asked them, please bring me a set of strings. And when She mailed them to me. So that was another set of problems because I was mailed strings, you know. And those strings held for the duration of high school for me. So 9th through 12th grade, sometimes the E string would pop and then you could use something not that amazing. And I remember right before, like at some point, I changed them, but I used them for a long time and you just got used to it. So those were things that nowadays I look back and I'm like, did it really happen? Because you make peace and you look back and it's all, you have to make peace with this. So super strict academic program, very dedicated teachers. We learned so much in school and everybody was very dedicated. It was a little bit pressure oriented that now I don't think I appreciate it. So a few words about the high school structure. You had to go through an admission process. You chose a certain high school oriented of mathematics and physics, anything, music. You had to choose one. And then you went through a week of exams. You could fail and go into the, like, learning a trade. So it was a lot of pressure to really get it. And music high school had admission sooner, so if you didn't get in, and most people didn't, you could go immediately to another high school. Middle of high school, now they gave it up in Romania, but it lasted for quite a while, even after the revolution. They called that steps. In entering 11th grade, you had to do another exam to stay in that specific high school. And if you didn't, you went and learned a trade. So what else do you want as an incentive to do your homework and study? We were on it. There was no, I couldn't imagine not doing my work. So all I remember is that we went to school and then I went to my practice room and practiced. Sometimes my boat fall off my hand. I was so tired. Not that I didn't take breaks, but it was a lot of practicing, a lot of stuff we learned, etude scales. They left nothing uncovered. And homework when I took a break. And I really enjoyed taking a break and doing my homework. I remember being like very serious kids and didn't really take time off. Sundays weren't off, Saturdays weren't off, we just practiced. Most of us practiced very, very hard. The people that didn't just disappeared from the music life. They just didn't make it. Because they made it in such a way to thin it as you went along. Same in sports. I started to run in my hometown at around 5-6 years of age. I wanted to. They did the selection and they decided if you were doing it. Every few months, a few kids were sent home from the training program. So that's a competition that was healthy and not so healthy at some level. I hope for a future where there is more collaboration than competition. And I really respect the newest American research on pedagogy and how to encourage kids and students to work not under pressure but develop a love for learning, simply developing their curiosity and passion for something. For us it was, I knew what I wanted to do and you just kept on doing it. I think both systems have amazing qualities, and there is such I would say there is this globalization. So I think more and more the systems merge right now, and school systems, we all learn from each other. Back in the day, we were isolated enough that all we knew was what Moskova did. We followed the Moskova Conservatory program for violin. Everything. Our juries were an hour long. Everything memorized. That many bazillion etudes from which you picked two in the exam and memorized and scales and full concerto. And And we thought that was just normal. We just sat down and practiced. And then a few months later, another jury. The amount of repertoire we had to achieve by the end, it was 5 years program for us. By the end of the 5 years, you knew so much rep because there was no way around it. And very, very strict training. My regretted, beloved violin professor from the conservatory, she died in 2015. And I'm still heartbroken. I have not really recovered from her death. She died in her 60s and unexpected. Victoria Nicolae, one of the biggest names in pedagogy. I went to Cluj Conservatory for her, even though I took private lessons in Bucharest during high school. I really wanted to study with her, and I learned so much. And she was very loving, but strict as well. And very calm, and all the time, just calm. You could smoke inside the conservatory at that time. And I remember if I did something a little silly, or like I played something that didn't work so well, she would take a long puff from her cigarette and like hold it in, and then, "No, dear. Not like that." Very, very, very sweet and very respected. And she would tell us, if you're called to replace somebody as a soloist, because we all knew a bunch of concertos, organize them. And at that time, I thought, this is so silly. She said, 1 month notice, a week notice, a day notice. And she said, as many of the concertos you can, put them in the 1 day notice. And you would laugh, but those things happen. And they, you know, a soloist breaks a finger. The orchestra rehearsed, everybody's ready, and somebody has to go in and play. So they start calling. It's very interesting how I fielded some of those phone calls sometimes. And it nerve-wracking, but yet we were used to that. What do you do? They have the programs printed, everybody's going, but the violinist, something happened, you know. I finished the conservatory in 1998. I started we had a 1 year master program. And I'm looking at the academics and exams and recitals we had to do in 1 year. Now they promptly made it 2 years. But at that time, we didn't even blink. It was 2 full chamber recitals, 2 full solo recitals in 1 year, 4 academic classes, and a thesis. So that was the 1 year master's. They called it deepened studies. So therefore, I was allowed to come to the US and do my second master's because it wasn't technically the same degree, which is great. I came to the US after teaching in the conservatory for 3 years as an assistant professor of violin and chamber music. I was in the Arioso quartet, string quartet, at that time. We were in residence at the conservatory. I also played in the Philharmonic, but it wasn't a full time. You had to choose. So I played as much as possible, but you could not be full time in 2 places at that time, even though they were across the street. And I took a leave of absence to do a master's with a former student of Jascha Heifetz. That was my primary reason for leaving Romania at that time. Politically, Romania relaxed after the revolution in what way? That we could leave the country if we wanted to, if you found work somewhere else. And sadly, a lot of people left immediately after the revolution. Our best computer people, scientists, physicians, professors, artists, they left because the pay still was very low. The economy never recovered after the revolution because it would take a PhD thesis to explain it all. But we couldn't really recover after that. And my decision to leave was to work with this former student of Jascha Heifetz because he came to Romania. He's Romanian. he gave a master class and we worked together. I was in my third year, a junior. And he said, if you're ever interested to come and study with me, please contact me. And I said, well, I'll finish the conservatory, see what's going on. I really was impressed with him. So he came back to Romania. I was already teaching at the conservatory. And he said, he heard me perform. And he said, what are your thoughts? I said, if I'm granted the leave, I'll come. So I had to quickly learn English to pass the TOEFL, Test of English as a Foreign Language. And by quickly, I mean really quickly. And I passed it, like, barely. And I got admitted at Bowling Green State University in Ohio on a graduate assistantship. I would have had no other possibility to come. Because, you know, you can't work off campus if you're not a citizen. And who has the time if you really want to do your job and work? So I studied with him for 2 years, completely changed my life, completely. It was wonderful. He really taught me how to think outside the box, because I came very solid. I was solid, no problem with my technique. And he said, well, I owe him so much. I owe him so much. Vasile Belushka is his name. He just retired a few years ago from Bowling Green State University. And I think that's a great loss for the contemporary violin school, because he's one of the greats. And he's playing. Sometimes I would hear recordings of him and I would immediately think, my God, it sounds like Jascha Heifetz. And he didn't even try to imitate him. Of course, my former professor, Vasile Belushka, was a child prodigy and his playing was incredible when he went and studied with Jascha Heifetz. So after that, I went to College Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati. I did my artist diploma there with Won Im Bim, a South Korean professor, former student and assistant to Dorothy DeLay at Juilliard. Wonderful. We communicated so well. I really wanted to work with him. I came back to Bowling Green State for a doctorate in contemporary music, because I really, really have a passion for new music, a lot of passion for new music. And I worked with Dr. Penny Thompson-Cruz, fabulous professor and mentor, and I learned so much new music. I worked with contemporary composers. I learned so much. You know how you could think, oh, the doctorate is just another paper? No, no, I learned that doctorate at Bowling Green State is very serious. I think there are only two or three in the whole United States in contemporary music. Very hard to get in, very hard to get out. So I graduated in 4 years, which was a miracle, and like on time. And I wrote my thesis on the solo violin works of Samuel Adler, Shulamit Ran, and Chen Yi. And I interviewed all three of them. I did the Eastern European premiere and North American premiere of Memory for solo violin by Chen Yi. And I played all of those works that I wrote about. I analyzed them. It was a long project, and I think it would help other violinists to approach, because I always want to know what it happened in the life of the composer when they wrote this music. What were they thinking about, and what exactly in that music is connected to that exact event in their life? So it was a very good subject for me. You know, when you choose your doctorate thesis subject, you try a few before. For me, it was meaningful because all three of them immigrated to the United States. So the blend of the American music with their country, the folk music, anything, it was fantastic. All three of them the greatest probably alive, and yet so humble. And they took the time to sit down and talk to me and take me through what happened when they wrote those pieces. And so that was a tremendously satisfying project for me. And after that, I taught some at Bowling Green. I have been teaching at Heidelberg University since 2004 while I was going through the degree programs. That was very hard. And then at the College of Worcester, I taught there for 2 years. Fantastic private college, one of the top in the country. And then in 2015, in the fall, I made several job applications, and I was very attracted to USD because of the Rollins Piano Trio and because of the whole music program and National Music Museum, everything. It was fantastic. So I sent the application kind of thinking, well, you know, who knows, very relaxed. And then I'm hearing that I got a phone interview, and that's actually, I was like, no way, I won't pass this stage. So I had so much fun during the phone interview. Just, I was relaxed because I said, oh, you know, this will be it. And let's, what a great honor to talk to those people. And of course, the professional technical questions, no problem, I know what I'm doing. So I expressed my teaching philosophy and very exact questions. But I felt so relaxed, and I wasn't nervous at all. And sure enough, a few days later, somebody said, we got a phone call from them. I was like, my God, they are calling my references. And then I got an email. I got a phone call from the dean inviting me on campus, Dean Lariscao, whom I absolutely respect and admire. We had the first conversation over the phone, and I was thinking, oh my God, this is happening. So I got sent a full recital, almost a full trio recital program to learn and come to campus. So it was a 2-day campus interview process, and that was quite tremendous. I rehearsed with the members of the trio twice, and then we had a recital, and I had a teaching part of the interview. And yeah, I was hired, and feels fantastic to be here, and lots of performances, and a lot of exact work to be done, and challenging in the best possible way. I grew a lot as a musician. People here in this area are unbelievably friendly. I think that goes for the whole United States. That's one thing I deeply appreciated from the first moment I came here in 2001. I never felt like anybody treated me like a foreigner. And I barely spoke English when I came, and everybody was so supportive. Oh, you speak so well. You're doing great. The proverbial American optimism, that was fantastic for me. Coming from the Eastern ex-communist bloc, I really thrived here. It was really beautiful to come to this land of possibility. And to me, this is not a cliche. This really was fantastic for me. Everything is within reach if you work hard and you do your job. I didn't feel ever any discrimination. Fantastic people that supported me along the way. I worked very hard to improve my English. I read for fun, almost only in English. And going through 3 degree programs, graduate degree programs in a different country, you surely learn the language because you write papers and papers and a lot of papers. So you have to, you know. And here I am. 2014, when I started my work at the College of Worcester, I don't know, one afternoon I looked on YouTube just to see if that tape was up. I was like, maybe it's there. It is there. It is there. And it started, and I started to cry anew. It was terrible. And in the same week, composer, percussion performer, Bridget Sloan, approached me and she said, do you want to play something together for violin and percussion? I said, yeah. So we got to listen to things. And I said, you know, knowing her and knowing myself, I said, there is a lot of stuff for violin and marimba, very soft, very sweet. I said, I'm kind of in the mood for something more powerful, violin and like timpanis or something. And I said, why don't you write something? Why don't you write it? And I said, I have something to tell you. So I sat her down, poor kid, and I told her the whole revolution story. And I played the tape for her, kind of not holding it together even when I played the tape for her. So she got to work on it, and we called it Unrest. So it starts, we premiered it, we did the world premiere here at USD in February 2017, and the university sponsored the travels and everything, wonderful support. So in my first faculty recital at USD, I'm almost laughing when I look back at the program I chose. It was so boom, like really, really, really heavy. And many people told me they have cried throughout and after, and it was like really moving. And I did call it Music of Unrest. That was the title of my recital. Anyway, Bridget Sloan did a tremendous job. The piece started with the tape, a little bit of the tape, not the whole minute of it, and it fades, you know. And then the violin is amplified. The violin comes with this super, super, the highest pitch you can get. And imagine the amplification with that eerie sound, because that's the sound I heard. I had this ring in my ears when I heard that tape, my brain was going in the wrong direction. So I tried to replicate that. It was very hard for me to actually stand up and play that piece. So the tape was going on and I was thinking, okay, don't start sobbing because you're on stage and you have to hold it together and play the piece. And I did. And people reacted so strongly to that piece. They really liked it. It was really moving because you have this dialogue between violin and timpanis. Unbelievably strong. So at some point, if we can, we will actually record it. It's hard to record something that has so much amplification. You have to have, you know, to know what you're doing. Prior to this, talking about my take on the revolution, I recorded Music Under Political Unrest, a CD of music for two violins. The College of Worcester sponsored the producing of the CD. And University of South Dakota will sponsor, is sponsoring me to release it, which is fantastic. So we recorded it in late 2015. With a former student of mine from the conservatory, who is now assistant concertmaster in Romania and Sibiu State Philharmonic. She traveled to the United States. We went to a studio in North Carolina, the most respected sound engineer I know. So we recorded there. And it's three Polish composers that suffered during the Second World War and after. Tremendous stories, Bacewicz, Spiszak, and Gorecki. Gorecki died not super long ago, actually. And Gorecki's work is probably the most earth-shattering because it's written shortly after the Hungarian Revolution. And he was so mad when he wrote it. It's like impossible. It's like you're looking through a broken mirror. It's wonderful, so powerful, very hard, impossibly hard. And I think we did a great job. And I was so touched by the generosity of the music department. I stepped into our dean's office last year because I really am eager to release it. And I'm Albany Records will release a violin concerto, but I did not, that I recorded Merlin Schutz's violin concerto, but I'm not paying for that, and I was so eager to release this one. So I went to our dean, Larry Scow, and he's a fantastic leader, and I sat down and I said, okay, there is this CD, I think it's wonderful, and I need help. And he said, well, that's it, we'll support this, go ahead. And he gave me contacts, and fantastic moment. So those are my outward reflection and output on the revolution. And I'm also very slowly writing a book, very slowly. And it's fiction with quotation marks. It's fiction. And I didn't know initially if it would be individual stories, because I heard so many stories from my parents, from people that came from a political jail in the middle of the night and knocked on your door and said, hey, I'm out, help me. And so things like that in a non-fiction book, like happening. So the main character is a female violinist, but it's not me. It's written in the first voice. It will be completed in the first voice, but no, it's not me, actually. So it's a lot of a lot of things that will describe life under communism and after and throughout the U.S.
Ioana Galou was our guest on Opus today. Her recording of Music Under Political Unrest will be released soon. And in the 2017-18 concert season, Galou will present the European premiere of Samuel Adler's Violin Concerto in Romania. Galou will perform works of Bach, Beethoven, Elgar, and Kreisler tonight at the National Music Museum in Vermilion. The concert features Galou playing a Cheruti violin from the museum's permanent collection with Dr. Susan Keith Gray, distinguished professor at USD and also a member of the Rollins Piano Trio, performing at the keyboard. This concert marks the debut of Siouxland Arts Live on Siouxland Public Media. There'll be a live broadcast of the concert at 7 o'clock this evening over 90.3 in Sioux City and 90.7 in Okoboji. The Siouxland Arts Live monthly series promotes the diversity and quality of musicians in Siouxland. The series can also be heard by accessing the station's live streaming service. Support for Siouxland Arts Live is made possible by the M.A. Martin Everest Foundation and the National Music Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota. All musical selections used in this program featured Ioana Galou in live concert recordings.